Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Hello and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we are speaking with Kimberly Ann Johnson.
They don't really think that pleasure is the pathway to the healing. And it is. It is. And pleasure also, even the word pleasure, you and I will have way different meanings and associations, connotations, all of that to what it even means.
Kimberly Ann Johnson is a sexological bodyworker, somatic experiencing practitioner, yoga teacher, postpartum advocate, and single mom, working hands-on in integrative women's health and trauma recovery for more than a decade. She helps women heal from birth injuries, gynecological surgeries, and sexual boundary violations. Kimberly is the author of The Call of the Wild, How We Heal Trauma, Awaken Our Own Power, and Use It for Good, as well as the early mothering classic, The Fourth Trimester, and is the host of the Sex Birth Trauma podcast.
Well, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today and for your patience with my technical difficulties this morning. I am really look forward to this conversation. And the more that I was researching for this interview and beginning to see and understand the intersections of your work, I became more and more intrigued. So I feel really excited for today.
Thank you so much. I'm excited too.
Awesome. So, where do we begin? There's so much good stuff here. But in your essay, Sex Work is Soul Work, you write, quote, most people are dissatisfied or mystified by sex because they don't know how to get to these transformative zones. Instead, they are trapped in conversations about how many times a week they're doing it, or if they have multiple orgasms, or how they do it and pretend to love it, just so they don't have to do it anymore, end quote. Oh my gosh, there's so much to unpack there. I don't even know where to really begin with the question. I mean, we could almost unpack each of those little segments. But yeah, it's interesting why we try to even quantify our relationships like this. And so I don't know if there's a point that you want to start with, but I'd love to just tease all this apart with you.
Yeah. I should start by giving you a little bit of context and giving the people who are listening a little bit of context, like where I'm coming from and why I would even be talking about this. For 3 years, I worked with 800 women, and I do internal pelvic floor work together with trauma tracking. So I'm a sexological body worker and I'm a somatic experiencing practitioner. And I got into that work because my life was radically changed when I became a mother, specifically because I had a lot of tools before I became a mother. I worked at a yoga studio. Richard Freeman was my teacher, and he would teach that the foundation of every pose is the pelvic floor. So I was kind of a relative pelvic floor expert before I became a mom. And then I became a mom and my pelvic floor was completely rearranged. And then so were many of my organs, and I was in a lot of pain and I wasn't able to get help easily. And in the putting together of my own, the pieces of my own pelvis and my own psyche and transitioning into motherhood, which I did not think was going to be hard for me at all, because I love kids. I really wanted to be a mom, and I really trusted my body and trusted nature. So I just was completely blindsided by the fact that this was a huge transition. And for me, it took about 6.5 years to put myself back together and to feel like I had my life force again and that I could use my body the way that I wanted to. And I was kind of lucky, because now I've heard so many people's stories, so many women, you know, tens of thousands of women now, I've heard their stories about their gynecological, reproductive, and sexual health. And really, up to the point of giving birth, for me, I had easy periods. I'd never had any unwanted pregnancies. I had had a few sexual boundary violations that were really pivotal and kind of my first underworld journeys. But as far as like going to the gynecologist and that kind of thing, I hadn't had any negative experiences. So of course, then when I started hearing other women, it was like, holy, I mean, whoa, like what we go through gynecologically, reproductively, sexually, it's staggering. And, you know, women's health is really a bit like throwing darts at a dartboard, because most of the diagnoses that people come to me with are so incomplete and so monolithic, and it's pretty appalling. So in the midst of putting myself back together, I already had body work skills. I already had movement skills. A friend of mine said, you know, my tailbone's been hurting for 3 years. And I said, what happened 3 years ago? And she said, I had a baby. And I said, well, has anybody worked on you? And she said, no. And I said, okay, well, do you want me to try? And she said, yeah. And so I didn't have any training other than my Rolfing training, where we work in mouths and noses. But I said, okay, let me see. Let's just see. And in about 25 minutes, her tailbone unwound, and she never had any pain again after that time. And I started to see that the pelvis was this forgotten land, and it was draped in massage, and it was talked about with no gender when it was a yoga class. And, you know, energetically, in the practices that I knew from my lineages of spiritual practice, it was gender neutral and sex neutral. And I started to realize, like, wow, there's a really untended part of women that is not getting nearly the attention that it needs. And it's kind of a hidden treasure, because the tissue in the pelvis, in the vagina specifically, it changes very quickly. And most women have never been touched outside of a clinical situation or a lovership situation. There hasn't been very much neutral touch just to actually map the area. So in those 800 sessions that I did at that time, I really learned some common themes. And that work took me more deeply into sexuality, because shame is such a big piece of what women are working with, just based on sort of the very insufficient, I mean, and it's not only women that are dealing with that, but that's specifically the population that I work with. The layer of shame of inadequate sex education, not really knowing our own anatomy, not really knowing how our arousal works differently than male arousal. And then the layers of that, when we come to these other peak and heightened experiences like birth. So it's often that we would come to this territory again, and the earlier imprints are there with us. So it's such important territory that's usually considered so separate from our spiritual practice. And I mean, increasingly, that's changing. And that's changed in the 15 years since I really began this journey myself. I see a lot more education on menstrual health. I see a lot more education on the importance of the postpartum period. I see a lot more. I mean, just Instagram itself has popularized a lot more about anatomy, sacred anatomy, tantric practices. And yet I still, you know, I just was taught an in-person workshop for 2 days, and a lot of what we're working with is sexual imprints and curiosities, and really peeling back to very elemental places of contact and how we contact and who the contact is for. I'm very influenced by Betty Martin's work, The Wheel of Consent. I wish that I'm not crazy about the word consent, but it's about getting more clear about what we want and how we want it, and being able to communicate that without a layer of morality or shaming and blaming, and then getting really to the very essence of it, which is touch itself. So I try to help people understand when they say sex, what it is that they mean, and what it is that we, what all goes into that like tangled knot of yarn, the strands. What are those strands? So those strands could be pleasure, companionship, presence, feminine energy, masculine energy, if those categories mean something to a person, attachment, commitment. And then for each person, those strands connect. Some of them are knotted together. Maybe they're all just jumbled together. Some people really know what they're seeking out when they say the word sex. And then for a lot of people, it's just kind of a default place. So there's so much potential there. You know, I used to say that we could resolve a lot that we think we're taking to the therapy room, because a lot of people don't talk to their therapists about sex. Even if they're in relationship therapy, sex isn't really a part of it. It's another way that sex is considered something that's separate. And for most women that I've worked with, their sexual journeys and their spiritual journeys are very aligned. There tends to be like a parallel track that's moving when we start to really listen to each other's sexual stories and sexual desires, sexual assumptions. And because I really am a devotee of the nervous system, I tend to bring the nervous system lens to how I work with sexuality.
Yeah, the nervous system, it seems to be really important with everything we do, every type of relationship we have. And it makes so much sense how much it shapes the way we relate to our bodies and our sexuality and our sexual experiences. And in your essay, Sexual Authenticity, you write, quote, "Bringing consciousness to your true sexual desires and your patterns allow you to change the trajectory of your sexuality and bring it into alignment with who you are. Instead of resigning to sex as you think it should be, create sex as though it were art or a meditation, because it is. At its best, sex is co-created moment-to-moment experience that has the ability to transform you," end quote. Yeah, I want to hear more about this transformation, and also wondering, how does finding alignment and meaning within sex translate into other areas of life?
Oh, there's so much. And you know, a couple of things I didn't mention in that ball is also, you know, creativity and play. And it's a space where there's a huge potential, because our system becomes very malleable in sexual space. And that's why it can be really scary, because the way that the system can organize itself hormonally specifically is similar to any kind of trance state or psychedelic state. And so in that state, your system is a lot more impressionable, which is why if things don't go well, those become kind of deeper impressions, and you wonder, like, why is this taking up so much of my awareness when you know there's a lot of other things that could be taking it up as well. But the converse is also true, that, you know, I teach a whole class that's specifically about sexuality, and I don't teach any classes that are overtly called like healing sexual trauma. because positive reparative experience and education actually are a part of healing trauma. So a lot of times people think they have to go back over like all the bad things that happened or even all the mediocre things that happened. But we can create in real time experiences that, because they put a positive imprint, they just sort of shimmy out whatever it is that's unsettled, or, you know, the sort of boulders or rocks or pebbles that are in the sand. So I'm sort of divided right now. Like, part of me wants to kind of explain it from the, I know, and like the nervous system, even saying the words, the nervous system at this point is like the nervous system. I don't even know if those words mean anything anymore because it's everywhere and everyone's talking about it. And so maybe that in and of itself needs to be more grounded in like a specific example or just the technicalities of it. But pleasure is a huge part. People think that pleasure is kind of anathema to healing trauma. Like, pleasure is what you get after you heal your trauma. Pleasure is the cherry on the sundae after you have the hard conversation. The orgasm is what you get after you, you know, earn it, kind of thing. They don't really think that pleasure is the pathway to the healing. And it is. It is. And pleasure also, even the word pleasure, you and I will have way different meanings and associations, connotations, all of that to what it even means. Because we do, in Anglo-North America, we have a puritanical inheritance that is essentially polarizes work and pleasure. And work is valuable and pleasure is what you earn if you work hard enough. But basic pleasure, like the ability to allow something to feel good. So even right now, a listener could just tune in for a moment and go to the inside experience and just notice if there's anything that feels good. And usually when we're invited to notice a sensation, we immediately notice something that's painful. We go to like, oh, my back hurts, my neck hurts, my heart's beating fast. So it's a bit of a training to be able to notice something like spaciousness or, oh, my mouth's salivating, but actually that feels good. And then you could look out into your environment and see if there's anything that's pleasing to you in the space that you're in, or if you have a window and something that you see outside. And as you look outside, even just orienting outside of yourself, you might notice that you take a deeper breath or there's a sense of settling, because a lot of times we're really oriented, especially, you know, people who are listening to this podcast are people who really care about the planet, care about the health of other people, care about the future and what we're leaving to the next generations. And we can really get quite deep into the sense of grief and hopelessness and bad news and all of that. And it's important that we can be with grief, but it's also important just for our own health and well-being. And not that that's the, you know, the only thing that we're tracking, but we do also need to be able to touch into the present moment and the beauty that's around us. And when it comes to sexual boundary repair and just sexual health and sexual satisfaction and connection, and we can put the word sensual in there and we can put the word erotic in there, and we want to be in tune with the erotic, then we have to actually be able to see what we're looking at. And developing a relationship with pleasure. And so I think a lot of people hear that, and because there's so much out there now about self-pleasure practices, it's like all of a sudden people are thinking about, like, you know, developing a relationship with pleasure. Like, now I'm going to have to dance in the mirror every day and I'm going to have to like lather myself with oil. And that could be true. That could be a pathway. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's really just way more elemental than that. It's like, when you're walking down the street and you feel the sun and you turn your face towards the sun, can you actually be there in that moment and let that move into every cell of your body and allow yourself to have that moment that's as real as any of the ideas that we might have, any of the problem ideas about problems or ideas about solutions, but that's just what's happening right now. So a lot of my work is helping people be able to not only turn towards that, but establish it and feel that that's fully seeped into the cells of their body. And essentially, over time, the more that we practice that, and I worked with a man called Steve Hoskinson, and he calls it, he has a, I guess, a method. He was a somatic experiencing teacher, and now he teaches something called organic intelligence. He calls it a blue sandwich. So you look outside yourself into this, into the environment, and you see something, and you land your attention on it. And then you come inside and you find something that's blue. That's the meat of the sandwich or the filling of the sandwich. Something that feels good. And if nothing feels good, then you actually touch the surface of your skin so that you're in contact with your skin. So you feel the contour of your own body. And then you go back out into the environment. And you just do little blue sandwiches every once in a while. And it starts to train your attention that it's okay. And it will create more platform of resilience so that you can be with the waves, because, you know, life is life and life will do what it does, but we can have more resilience in our own system by establishing that relationship with pleasure. And that relationship to pleasure also allows us to have a better litmus test for what we don't like or what we're just basically accepting, but it's not great. It's just kind of the way things are. And it can be really satisfying to have that if you're in a sexual relationship with someone else, because you know the difference between going along, because it's easier to go along than to say stop or to say pause. And you know the trust that is built when you're also open to someone else saying that they're ready to pause or they're ready to stop or they would like to change positions, and instead of hugging, laying down, they'd like to sit up, or they'd like to sit side by side, or, you know, they'd like to come closer. So really working with these very elemental, I call it building the buffet of sex or the alphabet of sex, because usually when people think about sex, unfortunately, most of us still think about the bases. And I'm not trying to take that away from anyone if that's what they're really satisfied with. But most of the people that come to me are really, they know that there's like a treasure trove available to them where like there's so much that they could be accessing sexually that they're not. They just kind of know there's magic there, but they don't know how to get there. And so my job is to kind of show them the full palette and the full alphabet of like all of the options that are available in connecting. And a lot of times that has to do with the difference between hot sex and warm sex. So what we see out there in the culture a lot is hot sex, which is power oriented, you know, the Calvin Klein ad. It's very popular in polarity work now. Like, you know, you want your man to throw you on the bed type of stuff. That can be fun. And again, I'm not shaming anyone's desires or the way that they like to do things. But the people that I work with usually haven't ever seen an example of warm sex, which is less adrenaline and cortisol based and more oxytocin based. And they would like to at least develop a range for that, so they have an experience of what warm sex might feel like and what like long protracted orgasm might feel like instead of sharp and steep climaxes. So I think there's space for it all. But what I see is a lot of women who have been performing sex in a certain way for a while. And then there's like a huge life event, which could be motherhood. It could be a big life change, like a loss. It could be a change of phase of life where they're wanting something different and they don't know how to talk about it, because the only conversations they've ever really had have been about quantity or size or something that's exterior. They haven't really been invited to a conversation of what do I want sex to mean to me? What does it mean? Not like, oh, I'm an emotional person, but you know, what are my curiosities? How could I meet those curiosities? If I were to separate out these functions of pleasure and companionship and desire and access to play and improvisation, and then how might I like these to go together, and how could I communicate with someone, no matter what kind of relationship I'm in, no matter if it's a first date or a 20-year marriage, what could I arrive to that space with? So I think it's pretty radical. And for most people, when they're brave enough to turn to it, their whole life changes, because it gives you a type of energy that makes life feel worth it. You know, that when on the days that are hard to get out of bed, or you're worried about the latest crisis that's, you know, whether it's gun violence or environmental, or, you know, the latest cancel takedown, there's something that's very primal that fills us. And when not tended to, it tends to be a bit of an Achilles heel that's just sort of always there, that dissatisfaction is always kind of looming and feels really scary to turn towards, but also feels like it doesn't go away.
Silence in your heart is violence in your hand. There's no one to blame, 'cause nobody understands. And how would it feel if you had to run for your life and all of your days turn into the night?
Mm, yeah. I want to go back to what you were saying about the adrenaline sex versus the cortisol sex.
Oxytocin.
Mm-hmm. Oxytocin, right. Sorry. Yeah. It's really interesting to me. There's so many levels of why that's fascinating, actually. We probably don't have time in the last parts of our conversation to get into all of the facets. But I think maybe where to start with, following this thread of my curiosity, is how much sex in dominant culture is about power, which is something that you referred to as well. And how our conditioning around power and rape culture and patriarchy and, of course, pornography only, for the most part, feeds these narratives, these very specific narratives. And I feel like with that conditioning, these narratives start living inside of us. And then that's what we become attracted to, whether that's what we're attracted to in sexuality, or what we're attracted to buy things, or what kind of clothes we want to buy. Like, it's incredibly potent, these conditioned narratives. And sometimes, even in myself, I wonder, what is me and what is outside of me, and how has my desire been co-opted? What is it that I actually want versus what have I learned to want? And how do I even learn to separate that at this point? And then there's the bigger questions, which of course I could almost answer, but maybe I can't either, in terms of like, why is this power dynamic so sexualized? Like I said, I'm sure I could come up with my own responses for that, but I think it's really fascinating of, what does this conditioning do for the dominant culture? Like, if we bought into these narratives of power and dominance, and we even got turned on by them, what is that feeding? How are we supporting systems with our sexuality even? So I know I just asked a bunch of things and it was a bit stream of consciousness, but I would love to explore this more with you.
Yeah, I mean, My mind's going in a lot of different directions because I think that one of the great things about sex is it can be a really great way to explore power in ways that you might not be able to have it outside of that dynamic. You can have it in the dynamic. And so your system can get used to what it feels like to have it if you don't usually have it, and what it feels like to safely act out submission. But what I would say is that, and I don't want to like totally dogleg our conversation, but just as a bit of a frame, because I think it's really important. So we've all crossed boundaries and we've all had our boundaries crossed. And some of us have been in one of those positions much more than the other, but this is just part of being human. And my work is really about the predator-prey dynamic. And the predator being, we don't like that word in English, but the predator and the prey is just a relationship in the natural world. We need predators and we need prey. And some animals are only in one of those roles, and some of them are prey to some animals and predators to others. But in a nervous system, we need that full spectrum in our nervous system. And if we have it, then we're not acting out of a default. So, for instance, a predator is in the fight side of the nervous system, a healthy fight. It's healthy aggression. Predators only kill what they need in the wild. If they approximate domestication and they're feral, then they kill more than they need. So that's like a wolf in a hen house. But a wolf out in the wild that's not close to domestication, it just kills the food that it needs to eat. But we take that word and we think we make it moral and ideological. And one of the ways that I learned about this was watching a video of a wolf and a rabbit when I was in somatic experiencing school. And I was freaking out about the rabbit the whole time. I was like, oh my God, rabbit, why don't you see that wolf coming? What are you doing? Why aren't you running away? Like, it's coming closer. And then the rabbit collapsed because it froze. And then the wolf came closer and picked it up and shook it around to make sure that it was dead, because wolves don't like dead prey. And then it cast it off and the wolf ran off. And then the rabbit that was collapsed and had gone completely hypotonic slowly started come back to life and orient itself and then come into horizontal and then look around and then shake a lot and then hop off. And when the lights came up and everybody in the room had been watching that, they said, who identifies as the wolf? And immediately in my head, I was like, what freaking psychopath would identify with the wolf? And 30% of the people's hands in the room went up, and they were people that I liked. So I couldn't just say like they're bad people and that's why they identify with the wolf. And then I realized, oh wow, this is how over-identified with the prey that I am, like flight and freeze mode. This is my default. This is where I've been conditioned to be. It's much more comfortable. The emotional correlates to flight and freeze are anxiety, worry, panic in the flight, and confusion, disorientation, and helplessness in the freeze. And the emotional correlates in the fight are irritation, frustration, anger, and rage. And for most people, it's acceptable for people socialized as women to be confused and to be helpless, but we don't really like that for people socialized as men. And the converse is true. We don't really generally, and this isn't true in all time, in all cultures, for all people, but generally, we don't really like to see women very angry. And that's starting to change. And there's now books with the word rage on female rage on the cover, things like that, but that's relatively recent. And so I realized in that moment, oh, we've decided that predators are bad and men are usually predators, so men are bad, and prey is good and women are usually prey, so prey is good. And then those are moral and ideological frameworks, but they don't tend at all to the nervous system and to be able to have those corresponding patterns in your system. And so I started helping women physically occupy the wolf and be able to occupy all of the gestures that come with predation, which are focused gaze, zigzagging, the grinding of the teeth, salivating, showing your teeth, right? You can dominate a dog by showing them one of your canine teeth. Being able to look angry. So if you're angry, look angry. Don't try to disarm yourself. And to restore the self-protective gestures. Now, what wolves and rabbits don't have are a social nervous system. And the social nervous system is something that only human primates have. Not, of course, human, you know, animals have very complex social networks, but they don't have this specific vagal social nervous system. And in that system, that was developed for maternal bonding. So it's very estrogenous. It's estrogen and oxytocin based. And it's where on the, when we're under threat in the social nervous system, that's where fawning happens and it's where fitting in happens. So it's why women return to unsafe circumstances, because being closer to the threat is safer than being farther away from it. And so they approximate it and they don't know their needs and they go with the needs of the person or the thing that has more power. And so it's a physiological choice. It's not, of course, women are manipulative sometimes, but in this case, fawning is, it's a organic physiological way to not incur more danger or threat. And the other thing that happens in the social nervous system is fitting in. So camouflaging, not standing out, not being different, for fear of being ostracized and not belonging. And the social nervous system really disproportionately impacts females because of that estrogen cycle. And it's why you can see also that women who are exiting their fertile years become much less concerned about family and group togetherness and dynamics. They're much more willing to say, you know, I'm not cooking dinner, you all handle yourself. It's when a lot of divorces happen, because that there's not that hormonal compulsion to keep group together at any cost. And so when we're talking about power dynamics, in general, for most women who default to fleeing or freezing or to the fitting in and fawning, the reparative direction is coming into healthy aggression and predator energy. And that's being able to hold activation. And so it shouldn't be mistaken for being an alpha female or for being predatory in the sense that you're taking something that's not yours. Again, we're talking about the natural meaning in nature, what happens between animal dynamics, and that both are totally necessary. So when you know that you can protect yourself and defend yourself, and you know that you can stand your ground, then it's rare that you actually have to activate that circuitry, because your nervous system's already communicating that. You're coordinated between your facial expressions, your vocal tone, the content of what you're saying, and how you're organizing your body at the same time. So when we're talking about internalized power dynamics, is what I kind of heard you say, or like, you've seen ways of doing something and that might impact your preference for lingerie or partners or all different kinds of things. There's a lot to say about that. But what I really am a stand for instincts. And what I see happening, because I do have a 15-year-old daughter, like I said, and teens are coming into their sexuality much differently now than really at any other time in history. And because gender identity has become such an ubiquitous conversation, it's really enmeshed in their experience, the teens' experience with their sexuality as well. And they have all these labels to choose from. What's not happening is a lot of experimentation physically. What's happening is a lot of kind of intellectualizing and categorizing and wondering about, but without actually putting those actions in action. And that's just statistically what's happening as well, is that there's people are delaying sexual engagement much later and longer, which originally I thought was maybe good, like maybe people are having less sex they don't want. But now I'm seeing it's because we live in such a touch contentious culture that everyone's afraid of making mistakes. And we've become so hyperverbal about everything that it's the verbal and the enthusiastic consent and the talking that's the most trustworthy, that there's a big disconnect between talking and touching and having some kind of mutual agreements and trust. And, you know, and there's people that are so afraid, you know, most men that I know are very confused and afraid of being labeled as perpetrators. So they're muting their own arousal because they don't want to be too much. And they either have a relationship with porn and they're ashamed about it, or they're trying to get off it. But there's all these stereotypes and tropes about why it is that they're using it and what it's for. And so there's just a lot of confusion out there. And I want to be a part of helping people have a framework for how to tease it out. And so that we can have more contact that we want and more connection that we want and more positive relational experiences that are totally possible. Sex isn't really very PC most of the time. I think being respectful is politically correct and, you know, humanizing the person that you're with. But the rest of it happens more in the more physiological, biological. And then, as you're saying, like parsing out what our real elemental desires are. And I would also say that after this time of isolation, that I would expect that people are wanting a lot more comfort. And they might not know that's what they're wanting, but I've been noticing in my teaching that it's very hard for people to take comfort when it's offered to them. And that on a road to a sexual engagement with someone, that there would probably be, for a satisfying interaction, there would probably be a lot more comfort on the way to that interaction.
Into what the overarching themes of your work, well, the years of your work and your thoughts have brought you. And in A Hand in the Dark, a letter discussing your work with Stephen Jenkinson, you write, quote, "There are so many one-offs these days, one-hour podcast, one-hour interview summits, one-hour, quote, master classes. What happens if we dare to spend more time together? What happens if we dare to circle back? What happens if we sit next to someone and their body of work and give it time to develop so that the encounter works on us and in us?" End quote. Yeah, so I just want to ask, what happens when we devote ourselves to something in this way? Or what have you seen in yourself or in others?
There's so much there. When you were just reading it, what struck me was sitting next to body, and but I heard that body really loudly before I heard the body of work. And just for me, my life has become kind of increasingly isolated. I started working online about 7 years ago, and then I was ready to really move away from being online. In fact, I moved to New York City, to Brooklyn, in September 2019, because I was really wanting to be around more strangers and have exposure to just people and being next to people in different ways. And then my life got rerouted back to suburban San Diego in June 2020 when I learned that my daughter was gonna go to school online if I stayed in New York. And so as a consequence, I still feel that even though we're maybe, quote, post-pandemic, that I spend a lot of time alone if I'm not really deliberate about creating ways of being with other people. So there's the being willing to engage longer than one meme or 1 hour. And then there's the willingness to gather, which is becoming, it's going to become, it has become, and it will become even more important for us to be very deliberate about gathering, because there's less routinized ways for us to do that. And it's becoming less comfortable, even though mentally we might know that we need it. It's getting harder for us to actually do because we're getting out of practice. So on the bigger level for me, it's looking at ways of living and structuring my life so that I just am around people more of the time. And also that the people that I work with are around more people, because Stephen Jenkinson has this phrase, provisioning the loneliness. And in some ways, the work that I do with nervous systems is, it's about being a translator of the signals that your body is sending you. But many of those signals that are being sent are because we don't have mammalian proximity. And so there's some ways that it feels like a half step for me to be educating people online and helping them kind of, in some ways, like feel better about something that's not optimal at all. So I'm constantly kind of running those two tracks about how effective is this? Am I provisioning the loneliness by offering this? And, you know, I'm teaching a course right now called Mother Circle, Building Mother Culture. And I have women joining from all over the world. And in some ways, it's really magical and really powerful. And in other ways, I'm really advocating for them to take whatever it is that they're learning and share it locally. So that's kind of a broad view. But for me, working with Stephen Jenkinson and being with him now for about a year and a half, we didn't meet in person until about 9 months in. But for the last 6 months, we've seen each other maybe 15 times in different cities and different gatherings. I've become increasingly struck by how easy it is for people to make assumptions based on identity, and I'll just say specifically his identity, which people would categorize him as an older white man. So he kind of symbolizes for people what's wrong with the patriarchy and what's wrong with the world, and, you know, these broad sweep generalizations and words that are now just stand-ins for bad. And then as I get to know him more, both philosophically in his worldview, but also in his own personal life, I've never quite met anyone less willing to pull a card. So when someone speaks with him somewhat accusatorily about a point of view, and I can tell where they're coming from, they're seeing him as being anti-woman or anti-feminist or anti-progress, I know something about his personal life that I know that he could then stand up and say, and he never, ever does that. And so that's been a big learning for me, that he doesn't defend himself in ways that would be obvious in order for people to somehow take what he's saying as more palatable. And then just, you know, as someone who's considered a relative expert in my field of women's health and specifically birth and motherhood, but also gynecological surgeries and sexual boundary ruptures, is very surprising for people to see me in a type of apprenticeship. And so they see me and even when I'm in my quote unquote expert role, I'm still quite personal and vulnerable, but it seems to surprise people that I'm willing to sit next to someone who knows more than I do about many things and submit myself to that relationship. And if he had any other identity, that would be really more understandable for people. But because he comes from an ancestral background that's similar to mine, it's very confusing for people, is what I'm noticing. And at the same time, it seems to be fulfilling a kind of hunger that people have without knowing that they have it. So there's something that happens within us and between us as a result of coming back together with one another, unscripted, with real grief and real questions and real curiosities. So for me, it's been kind of the time of my life, honestly. It's overtaken me, and it's become, I have plenty of other projects and books that are sitting on my shoulders, but it's taken precedent in part because you can't be an apprentice to someone whose teachings are about finality and frailty and death without that presence being in the room and without knowing the finality even of the thing that you're doing. So, you know, he describes us as a young man, a young woman, no longer young, and an older man, not quite old. But it's a time-limited arrangement between us, and I know it, and he knows it. So I've stepped in there to be eldered and to do it publicly, which is a real high-wire act. It's a real razor's edge kind of engagement. You've interviewed him, so you can probably understand a little bit what that's like.
Mm. Yeah, and I'd recommend anyone listening right now, after you complete this conversation, to go back and re-listen to Stephen's interviews, and I think they would complement each other, as you both do so well. And yeah, as you were talking, the word that kept coming to me was authenticity. How do we connect in a real way? How do we feel the grief in a real way? How do we feel the finality? You know, these things, it to me, yeah, the word authenticity and presence kept coming. And yeah, I'm thinking about how your work in so many ways is about being with ourselves and with others and with this life in ways that can help us heal and grow and nourish. And I think that in so many ways, that these are very rooted activities. But I do wonder, how do we make tangible such ephemeral concepts that are real, or so that real and meaningful work can be done? And I guess just to maybe clarify, sometimes I think talking about finality or being, these concepts are so, they're deep. They live in deep time. And I want to help tease out how we bring them back into the physical world so that we know how to relate to them on a daily basis.
Well, it's interesting because I don't find finality itself to be ephemeral because it's happening all the time, right? Like, I have a plant on my kitchen table that's looks like it's on its way out. I'm not really that great with indoor plants. I've been trying to learn, but so I can't tell if it's just that I'm not good at letting it, like nurturing it in a way so that it continue to live, or if it's just had its time and it's ready to go. I'm also perimenopausal personally, so I'm almost 49, and it's a kind of finality. It's a finality of the fertile stage of my life. It's the finality of, which actually the fertile stage of my life probably ended, you know, 4 or 5 years ago from what I could feel. But the finality of the bleeding phase of my life. And if you look out in the world, there's all kinds of information about how to prolong aging and how to essentially try to get through this transition with as little bumps as possible. And it's really intense. It's very intense too, especially I think because, at least for me, my daughter's 15 and she's starting her fertile years. So it's just very, and I'm also getting married this year. So it's like, I have these concentric layers of things that are ending and beginning at the same time. And then I'm living a beginning and a maiden coming into her fertile years as I'm leaving mine. So there's lots of ways that finality is happening all the time, and it's not the final. I mean, death is happening all the time, but we're not, or I'm not around it. So I became very aware when I started to think back on my life, how many deaths have I been around? It was really one evening at the Burning Ghats in Varanasi, several times in India and Brazil, stepping by dead bodies. And then one, not even in-person death. I was with my grandmother in her dying time, but I was away on the day of her death. So I was actually there on FaceTime, which is bizarre, but true. And what is it to live in a culture where birthing time and dying time are just considered completely separate? So one wouldn't even realize, oh, I've never been at a birth, until we're in a birth, our own birthing time, giving birth. And we realize this is the first time we've even been in the energy, in the field of what it is to give birth. Unless, of course, somebody's raised on a farm or raised in a very particular kind of community where that is something that's a part of their daily, or at least, you know, yearly life, where you would be around people at different phases of their life. So for me, it's actually quite practical. And you know, miscarriages and abortions are finalities. They're endings of something, whether they're desired or not. It's an ending. And more likely than not, these days, if you tell someone that something is an ending, the next thing they say to you is every ending is a new beginning. And there's just an unwillingness to be with the ending without having to reframe that as something that's actually, you're growing because of it. Actually, you're getting better. Sure, wisdom comes from endings, hopefully. But for me, it's just really shifted a lot, because I was a yoga teacher and a body worker, and I came from, you know, the category of the wellness world, where everything is segued to the redemptive ending of hope. And so it's been a really big shift for me to recognize, and frankly, pretty disheartening to recognize how little tolerance and capacity that people have to be with an ending without just assuming that, you know, the ending of a day, that the next day is automatically coming, or the ending of a season. Okay, it's an ending of a season, but the next thing is coming. So for me, it's been quite practical, actually. And there's been a lot of felt sense experiences, because when I'm with Stephen Jenkinson, particularly, not just because he's older and not just because he has some health conditions, but because he's lived in the presence of death so much, there's a tangible feeling to that, of not the cliche of living the moment, or not the cliche of, you know, not living as if this day is your last, but a real palpable sense that this is like not holding things back. Like if it's the thing that needs to happen now, to be in relationship with timing, and to be courageously willing to meet the moment, and maybe say the thing that you're not supposed to say, right? There's just so many things out there right now that are like the script that you're not supposed to say, that you think the emperor has no clothes, but you're not supposed to notice it. And a real willingness to step into that now.
Thank you for listening to For the Wild podcast. The music you heard today was by Lake Mary and Katie Gray. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, and Julia Jackson.
KBOO, Portland, 90.7. It's the Reggae Bobcast Show, but wait a minute. Hold up. It's the Cinco de Mayo takeover is what's happening tonight. Cinco de Mayo takeover tonight. We've got myself and three wonderful Mexican, Hispanic, all that in the house. In the house. We're going to start off the show with the Mexican National Anthem and one other song. And we'll be back. How about a mic check? Mic check?
Yo, yo. Bring them off.
That sounds pretty good.
Check one, check two.
Let's see.
Check one, check two.
We're going to have to talk loud tonight.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Okay, check y'all. One. We'll be back. We're going to do the National Anthem. And back at your radio station, KPOO.
Good. Feeling good.